Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Masks of the Outcasts by Andre Norton. Narrated by Eric Michael Summerer. Cat's Eye. 1. Tequil was really three cities loosely bound together. Two properly recognized on the maps of Korwar's northern continent, the third a sore, rather than a scar, of war, still unhealed. To the north and west, Tequil was an exotic bloom on a planet that had harbored wealth almost from the year of its first settlement. To the east, fronting on the spaceport, was the part of Tequil in which lay the warehouses, shops, and establishments of the thousands of businesses necessary for the smooth running of a pleasure city, this exotic bloom where three-quarters of the elite of a galactic sector gathered to indulge their whims and play. To the south was the Dipple, a collection of utilitarian, stark, unattractive housing. To live there was a badge of inferiority. A man from the Dipple had three choices for a cloudy future. He could try to exist without sub-citizenship and a work permit, haunting the casual labor center to compete with too many of his fellows for the very limited crumbs of employment. He could somehow raise the stiff entrance fee and buy his way into the strictly illegal but flourishing and perilous thieves' guild. Or he could sign on as contract labor and be shipped off-world in deep freeze, with no beforehand knowledge of his destination or work. The war of the two sectors had been fought to a stalemate 5 years ago. Afterwards, the two leading powers had shared out the spoils, spheres of influence. Several major and once richer planets had to be written off entirely, since worlds reduced to cinders on which no human being dared land were not attractive property. But a fringe of frontier worlds had passed into the grasp of one or the other of the major powers, the Confederation or the Council. As a result, the citizens of several small nations suddenly found themselves homeless. At the outbreak of the war 10 years earlier, there had been forced evacuations from such frontier worlds. Pioneers had been removed from their lands so that military outposts and masked solar batteries could be placed in their stead. In this fashion, the Dipple had been set up on Korwar, far back from the fighting line. During the first fervor of patriotism, the Dipple dwellers met with goodwill. But later, when their home worlds were ruined or traded away across the conference tables, there was resentment, and on some planets there were organized moves to get rid of these rootless inhabitants. Now, before dawn in Tequil, men from the Dipple leaned their bowed shoulders against the outer wall of the casual labor center, or squatted on their heels before the door that marked the meeting place between the haves and the have-nots. Troy Horan watched the pale gold in the morning sky deepen. Too late to mark stars now. He tried to remember the sky over Norden, and had again one of those sharp picture flashes of recollection. A silver bowl arching above a waving plain of grass, grass that was pale green, mauve, and silver all at once, changing as the wind rippled it. He knew the warmth of a sun always half-veiled in rainbow haze, felt the play of muscles as the animal he perched upon as a small boy, rather than bestrode, broke into a rocking canter. That was one of his last memories of Norden. They had been out riding track, cutting a wide circle about the grazing herd of Tupan to check that none of the animals had drifted toward the quicksands near the river. It had been that same morning that the Council ships had cut out of the sky, burning portions of the plain to charred earth and slag with their tailbursts. Within 3 days, Troy and his people had left Norden for Korwar. Three Horans, a small clan among all the others, but not three for long. His father, big body, laughing voice, quiet, steady eyes, a pair of hands that did everything well, a man who was able to establish a strange bond of sympathy with any animal, had put on a trooper's tunic and vanished into the maw of a transport. Lang Horan had not returned. After that, the big cough had hit the Dipple, leaving only Troy Horan, a lanky adolescent who inherited skills and desires for which there was no need on Korwar. He also possessed a stubborn, almost fierce independence, which had so far kept him either from signing on as contract labor or from the temptation offered by the guild. Troy Horan was a loner. He did not take orders well. And since his mother's death, he had no close attachments in the Dipple. There were few left there now who had come from Norden. The men had volunteered as troopers, and for some reason, their families had been particularly susceptible to the cough. The door that was their gate to the day's future slid back. Men stood away from the wall, got up. Mechanically, Troy made a brushing gesture down the length of his thin torso, though nothing would restore a vestige of trimness to his clothing. Spacer's breeches, fifth hand, clean enough, but with their sky blue now a neutral, dusty gray. Spacer's boots, a little wide for his narrow feet, the magnetic insets clicking as he walked. An upper tunic that was hardly more than a sleeveless jerkin, all in contrast to the single piece of his old life that he wore pulled tight about his flat middle. That wide belt of a Norden rider was well oiled, every one of its silver studs polished and free of tarnish. Those studs formed a design that was Troy's only heritage. If he ever rode the grass plains again, with Tupan galloping ahead, well, those Tupan might bear that same pattern on their cream-white hides. Lang Horan had been rangemaster and brand owner. Because he was young, tough, and stubborn, Troy was well to the fore of the line at the mechanical assigner. He watched with alert jealousy as three men ahead ran toward the stamper, assured of work, the mark on their wrists giving them the freedom of the city, if only for a day. Then he was facing that featureless, impersonal Mike himself. Horan, Class 2, Norden, lawful work. The same old formula he uttered there day after day. He stood, his feet a little apart, balancing as if the machine were an opponent ready for battle. Under his breath, he counted five quickly, and a tiny hope was born. Since he had not been rejected at once, the assigner did have some request that might be matched by his meager qualifications. The five he had counted doubled into 10 before the assigner asked a question.
Knowledge of animals?
That of a Norden herd rider. Troy stretched the truth to a very thin band, but his small hope was growing fast. The assigner meditated. Troy, through his excitement, felt the impatience of the men behind him. Yet the length of time the machine was taking was so promising.
Employed.
Troy gave a small gasp of relief.
Time of employment, indefinite. Employer, Kasi Kiger. First level, 6th square. Report there at once.
The plates in his boot soles beat a rataplan as he hurried to the stamper, thrust his hand into the slot, and felt that instant of heat that set the work mark on his tanned wrist. First level, 6th square, he repeated aloud, not because it was so necessary to impress his memory, but for the pure pleasure of being able to claim a work address. 6th square lay on the outer fringe of the business district, which meant that Kiger was engaged in one of the upper-bracket luxury trades. Rather surprising that such a merchant would have need for a CLC hireling. The maintenance force and highly trained salesmen of those shops were usually of the full citizen class. And why animals? Horan swung on one of the fast-moving roll walks, his temporarily tattooed wrist held in plain sight across his wide belt to prevent questions from any patroller. Because it was early, the roll walks were not crowded, and few private flitters held the air lanes overhead. Most of the shutters were still in place across the display fronts of the shops. It would be midday before the tourists from the pleasure hotels and the shoppers from the villas would move into town. On Korwar, shopping was a fashionable form of amusement, and the treasures of half the galaxy were pouring into Tilsil, the result of stepped-up production after the war. Troy changed to another roll walk. The farther westward he went, the more conspicuous he became. Not that clothing was standardized here, but the material, no matter how fantastically cut and pieced together, was always rich. And the elaborate hair arrangements of the men who shared the roller with Troy, their jeweled wristbands, neck chains, and citizens' belt knives, took on a uniformity in which his own close-cropped yellow hair, his weaponless belt, his too thin, fine-boned face were very noticeable. Twice, a patroller stirred at a checkpoint and then relaxed again at the sight of the stamp on the boy's bony wrist. Sixth Square was one of the areas of carefully tended vegetation intended by the city planners to break the structure pattern of the district. Troy jumped from the roller and went to the map on a side pillar.
Kiger, he said into the mic.
Kigers, the finder announced. Gentle homos, gentle femmes, visit Kigers, where the living treasures of 1,000 worlds are paraded before you. See and hear the Lumian talking fish, the Dofold, the priceless Faxian changecoat, the only one of its kind known to be in captivity alive. Follow the light, gentle homo, gentle femme, to Kigers, merchant dealer in extraordinary pets.
A small spark, which had glowed into life on the wall below the map, loosed itself and now danced through the air ahead, blinking with a gem flash.
A pet shop?
The inquiry about animal knowledge was now explained, but Troy lost some of his zest. The thin story he had told the assigner was now thinner, to the point of being full of holes. He was 10 years out of Norden, 10 years away from any contact with animals at all. Yet Troy clung to one hope. The assigner had sent him, and the machine was supposed to be always right in its selection. He looked about him. The massed foliage of the center square was a riot of luxuriant vegetation, which combined plants and shrubs from 6 worlds into a pattern of growing. Red-green, yellow-green, blue-green, silver. And he began to long with every fiber of his semi-starved body that he would be the one Kiger wanted, even for just one day. His spark guide danced up and down, as if to center his attention on the doorway before which it had paused, and then snuffed out. Troy faced Kiger's display and drew a deep breath of wonder, for he seemed to be staring at 4 different landscapes, each occupying 1/4 of the space. And each landscape was skillfully contrived so that a section of an outlandish planet had been transported in miniature. In each, small creatures moved about the business of living and dying. It was all art tri-D, of course, but the workmanship was superb and would completely enthrall any prospective customer. Reluctantly, Troy approached the door itself, a barrier where plexiglass had been impressed with a startling and vivid pattern of weird and colorful insects, none of which he recognized. There was no sign that the establishment was open for business, and he had no guide to lead him behind the massive buildings to a rear entrance. Troy hesitated uncertainly before the closed door until, among the imprisoned creatures of the center panel, a portion of face with reasonable human features appeared. Round dark eyes set in yellow skin regarded him with no trace of interest or emotion. Troy held up his wrist so that the employment mark might be fully visible to those eyes. Unblinkingly they centered upon it. Then the stretch of yellow cheek, the broad nose, vanished. The creatures in the panel seemed to flutter as that barrier arose, and a flow of warm air, redolent with many strange smells, engulfed Troy. As if drawn by an invisible cord, he entered Kiger's. He was given no time to look about the outer reception lounge with its wall cabinets of more miniature otherworld scenes, for the owner of the eyes was awaiting him impatiently. Used as he was to oddities, human, humanoid, and non-human, Troy still found the small man strange enough to study covertly. He could have walked under Horan's outstretched arm, but his small, wiry body was well-proportioned and not that of a dwarf. What hair he had was black and grew in small tufted knobs tight to the rounded bowl of the skull. In addition, there was a rough brush of the same black on his upper lip, and 2 tufts or knots on his chin, one just below the center of his lower lip and the other on the point of the jaw beneath. His clothing was the conventional one-piece suit of an employed sub-citizen, with the striking addition of a pair of boots clinging tightly to his thin legs and extending knee-high, fashioned of reptile skin as soft as glove leather, giving off tiny prismatic sparks with every movement of their wearer. About a slight pot belly, he had a belt of the same hide, and the knife that swung from it was not only longer but also wider than those usually worn in Tequil.
Come.
His voice was guttural.
A crook of finger pointed the way, and Troy followed him through two more showrooms into a passage from which opened a number of screened doors. Now the effluvium of animal, a great many animals, was strong, and sounds from each of the screened doors they passed testified to the stock Kiger kept on hand. Troy's guide continued to the end of the hall, set his small hand into the larger impression of a palm lock, and then stood aside for Horan to enter. If the yellow man was an oddity, the man who sat waiting for Troy to cross his office was almost as great a surprise. Horan had seen many of the merchants of Tequil, and all of them had been glittering objects indeed. Their jewels, their ultra-fashionable dress, their eye-catching coiffures had all been designed as advertisement to attract general attention. But Kiger, if this was Kiger, was no such starburst. His muscular body was covered with a Hora silk half-tunic and kilt, but the color was a dark and sober blue, and he wore no jewels at all. On his right wrist was the broad service bracelet of a veteran spacer, with at least two constellations starring its sweep, while his skull was completely shaven as if to accommodate the helmet of a scout ship man. The bareness of that deeply tanned stretch of skin made the red, puckered scar down along his right ear the more noticeable. Troy wondered fleetingly why he chose to keep that disfiguring brand. Plastic surgery could have erased it completely. The other regarded Troy for a long moment, his stare both as aloof and as searching as that the yellow man had used through the door panel.
"The assigner reported you as Norden," he remarked, but gave the planet name a slight accent new to Troy. "I would rather have thought Midgard."
Troy met him eye to eye. This man had a spacer's knowledge of racial types and other worlds right enough. "I was born on Norden." The other might not have heard him.
"Midgard or even Terra?"
Troy flushed. "Norden," he repeated firmly. Lang Horan's father had been from Midgard right enough. Before that, well, who traced any planet pioneering family back through generations and star systems to the first hop?
"Norden. And you think that you know something about animals?"
Those gray eyes, cold as space between far-flung suns, dropped from Troy's face to the belt with its lovingly polished silver studs.
"Rangemaster, eh?"
Troy refused to be drawn. He shrugged, not knowing why the other was trying to bait him. Everyone knew that Norden had been handed over to the Confederation, that none of her former inhabitants could hope to return to her plains.
"All right. If the assigner sent you, you're the best it could find."
Kiger arose from the enveloping embrace of his easy rest. The yellow man slipped to his side.
"Zul will give you your orders. We are expecting a shipment in on the Chasgar. You'll go to the dock with Zul and do just as he tells you. No more, certainly no less. Understand?"
There was a flick of razor-sharp whip in that. Troy nodded. Zul was certainly not a talkative companion. He merely beckoned Troy out through another door into a courtyard. This, too, was sided with pens and cages, but Troy was given no time to inspect their inhabitants. Zul waved him to a waiting flitter. As Troy took his place in the foreseat, the small man reached for the controls and they lifted with practiced ease to the air lanes. Zul circled, then headed them toward the west and the spaceport. There was more traffic aloft now. Personal flitters, heavier vans, and small flyers such as their own. Zul slipped through the lanes with a maximum of speed and a minimum of effort, bringing them down without a jar on the landing strip behind the receiver station. Again, a jerk of thumb served to bring Troy, trailing his guide, into one of the many entrances of the clearance section. His small companion was well known here, for he bypassed two barriers without explanation, their guardians waving him on.
"Kigers,"
Zul spoke at last, putting a claim disc down before the man in charge of the third grill.
"Right section, third block."
Now they were in a corridor with a wall on one side, a series of bins, room size on the other, each well filled with shipping crates, bales, and containers. There were men hauling these in and out, which testified that the contents of the packages in this particular section were too precious to be left to the mechanical transportation of the port robots. Zool located the proper bin room and dropped his disc into the release frame at the door. The protecting mesh rolled up, and a light flashed on above two crates and a large, well-padded travel cage. All three packages were bulky, and Zool, fists on hips, eyed them closely before he said over his shoulder,
"Get a truck."
Troy went back up the corridor to claim one of the motored platforms. He was wriggling that out of a line of its fellows when he caught a half-glimpse of a face. A familiar face. As he jumped on the platform, dug his boot toe into the activating button, and headed the vehicle down the line, he wondered just what would happen if he shouted out that a newly accepted member of the Thieves Guild was working here, in the very center of the supposedly best-protected treasure transshipping center on Korwar. Every man who entered this building had been scanned by the psycho check at the door, and everyone not on legitimate business would have been unmasked by that latest weapon in the armory of the patrollers. Yet Troy was certain he had seen Julnuk Varms shifting a crate, and he knew for a fact that Varms had crossed the line into the apprenticeship ranks of the guild. The platform rolled to a stop before Zool, and they went to work shifting their cargo to its surface. Each piece was heavy enough to require the combined efforts of the mismatched workers, and Troy wiped his hand across his face as the second settled into place. He eyed the curtains covering the sides of the cage, wondering just what kind of exotic creature cowered within. Cowered? That was the wrong word. The inmate of that cage was curious, interested, alertly eager, not in any way cowed. Inmate? Inmates, two of them. Troy stood very still, staring at the closely curtained transport cage. How did he know that? Interest, now increasing, something touched him, not physically, but as if a very soft, inquiring paw had been drawn lightly along his arm to test the quality of his skin, the strength of his muscles, the toughness of the bone beneath that covering. Just so did he feel that something had very lightly touched what was his inner self in exploration. Touched, and flashed instantly away, so that the sensation was cut off almost the same moment that he was aware of it. Troy helped Zool boost the cage onto the platform. There was no feeling of movement from within. Nothing at all. Had there ever been? 2. The cage was stowed with extra care just behind the driver's seat in the flitter, and during the transfer from warehouse to flyer there had been not the slightest sound from its interior. Yet twice more Troy had been aware of those paw taps of exploration, touches that were gone the instant he was alert to them. He was thinking hard as he left Zool in the flitter and went to return the platform. The other had shown no signs of surprise or interest in the cage. Did Zool find those subtle inquiries ordinary, or did he not feel them at all? What kind of species of animal traveled in that container? Native life on a thousand worlds was now known to spacers, explorer scouts, pioneers, and Troy had heard tales told in the Dipple by men gathered from planets in a wide sector of the galaxy. Yet never before had there been any suggestion that a form of life existed that was able to contact men mentally. Mentally. Troy paused. Mentally. So, that was it. He had put a name to that elusive touch. But he did not know that his eyes had narrowed, that his fingers were drumming a faint tattoo on his belt. This was something to consider by himself. Out of the far past, an emotion other than surprise awoke, sent a warning through him. Look, listen, and keep one's thoughts to oneself. The law of survival. Troy swung around so suddenly that he caught the slight movement of a man he must have startled into that tiny betrayal. Varms stood just outside, his elbow resting on a pile of boxes, obviously waiting for orders. Yet he had been watching Troy, just as he was so patently not watching him now. Did Varms expect Horan to spark a patroller? He knew the inner laws of the Dipple better than that. As long as Varms made no move toward looting Kygers, where Troy's loyalty was temporarily pledged, Horan would not reveal any knowledge of him. He walked past Varms without a sign, heading toward the flitter. It was only chance that dictated the next warning. A porter was wrangling with one of the bin attendants, and they now carried their quarrel to the section manager. Since the object of their dispute was large, they were hot-tonguing it, not in the inner office but outside in the corridor. A length of crystal mirror, bright and backed with red gold, bore a disfiguring crack down its side. That crack might distort a reflection, but it could not conceal it. And in that patch of mirror, Troy caught a glimpse of a tailor, Varms. The interest a new recruit of the guild might have in a CL from the Dipple was negligible, but in a cargo, that was a different matter. And Varms, clumsy and inept as he was, might well be after the contents of the cage, or of the two crates that accompanied it. Troy came out into the brightness of the flitter park. There were rows of waiting vans, very few passenger flyers. A series of two-story patroller towers quartered the whole area. There must be spy rays throughout every lane here. No one had ever dared a hijacking job in this place, and he did not see how he and Zul could be tackled once they were in the air. If they had been on wheel lock, now... But he discovered that surface travel was just what Zul was intending. The wheels were extended from the body flaps, and the little man edged the vehicle out on ground level. "What's the idea?" Troy folded his long legs into the cramped quarters beside Zul. "Don't we lift back?" For the first time, those wide lips split in something approaching a grin.
"No, no lift back,"
the other mimicked his tone.
"We carry those who must ride easy."
Not much of an explanation, Troy thought. If the occupants of the cage had managed to survive passage in a space freighter, they certainly could take very easily a short air flight back to Sixth Square. He had something other to chew on also, that move by Varms. Taken together with this action of Zul's, it began to make sense. Could the yellow man and the novice thief have rigged a hijack between them, with himself set up to pin the blame upon? Troy dismissed that thought. Too many loose ends. He was not driving. Zul was. He could prove that he had no connection with Kygers before this morning, knew nothing of any cargo that was coming in for the shop. And somehow he was certain Zul was not planning any double cross of his employer, in spite of Varms. But there had to be a reason, other than the one he had been given, for this ground-level progress. It was not a straight-line progress either, he noted. Troy knew the warehouse section of Tequil well enough to be certain with every block they passed that Zul was taking a roundabout way. Why? A sidelong glance at the other's closed face argued that this was another question Zul was not going to answer. Troy settled back as far as he could in a seat adjusted to Zul's comfort, not his own, and waited for further enlightenment. Once more he was conscious of activity in the cage, mental activity. It was no longer directed toward him, but at their surroundings. Troy's breath caught in a tiny gasp as he realized, picking impressions and hints out of those vague, strange currents, that the occupants of the cage were engrossed in studying their new surroundings. Yet how could they see through the thickly padded covering of the cage, unless that covering was not what it seemed to superficial examination? He would have given a great deal at that moment to be able to turn and sweep the covering to the floor of the flitter, to see the unseen. A great deal, but not today's employment. Troy was very sure that such a move on his part would see Zul's summoning of the nearest patroller, his own ignominious and disastrous return to the Dipple. Curiosity was not spur enough to risk that. They made two more unnecessary turns. There were other flitters wheeling, usually private jobs delivering passengers to the buildings, so Zul's method of progress was in no way extraordinary. But Troy's attention went now to the VISA screen above the controls. He watched for Varms. Was the other still trailing? He could pick out no following flitter that seemed suspicious. but Troy would be the first to admit that he could not match skills with any of the guild.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?